The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and a big welcome to the March 9th, 2013 edition of my Saturday afternoon radio show. I am Carolyn Yeager, and my guest today is Charles Kraft, the Seattle artist who has found himself in the midst of a furor over revelations that he might be a Holocaust denier and even a white nationalist. As we know, Holocaust denial is the mark of Cain in our society, dominated as it is by a nearly totally Jewish-owned media. We will be taking calls in the second hour, but hold calls until we are back on the air following the break. Charles, I'm extremely pleased that you are here.
Thank you for having me, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, that's nice. You know, Charles, I consider you a brave man for coming on this particular program again after all the trouble you've gotten into. From the last time you were on this very show, the Saturday afternoon show, and that was on July 28th, and Hadding Scott was on that show also with you and I. And never did I think it would turn into something like this. And this actually is where they proved to themselves that you had said certain things that were, you know, unacceptable to them. But you have come on, and as I've told you, I think you are a man of destiny. I really do, because I think this might have far-reaching effects. Do you have any comment to that?
The effect that I think I've had or may have is to move the dialogue into the arena of culture rather than politics.
So excellent.
The culture makers might take note of some of the issues that are present in this controversy. And that's my if I've contributed anything, it would be just to move it into a different direction.
Well, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I don't think I'm particularly a man of destiny. I just introduced some of the issues to a new audience.
Well, I say that because you didn't do it on purpose, really. I mean, in that sense, you weren't going to, you did do it. You probably had some idea maybe that, you know, what this could mean because you've been doing this art for some time. This type of art. But, you know, I want to ask you right now, I've got a tentative title for today's program, How Charles Kraft Inadvertently Forced the Art World to Deal with Holocaust Denial. I wanted to know if that bothered you. You know, I don't want to say anything that's going to make things harder for you. And maybe I should even leave out the inadvertently. I stuck that in there as a kind of protective device. Because I thought that, you know, it is inadvertent, but maybe you feel a little bit differently, if you know what I mean.
I go ahead and use the title. We have to define what Holocaust denial is, because we're using words that are pejorative for revisionism, and that it's a weapon. Holocaust denial, that word. So I have an issue with it, because we're not denying the Holocaust. If you get involved in this stuff, you realize that when it appears in print, people think you are not cognizant or of the Holocaust itself, the camps and the whole history of the roundup of the Jews and forced labor and all this business.
Okay, we'll get into that. If you don't, we will get into that. I didn't want to rush into that too soon.
Yeah.
So I want to bring up the fact, just starting out here, that you've become busy with interviews. And then we're going to go into some of your history as an artist. But before we do that, I think I'd like you to mention some of these upcoming interviews and people that have already interviewed you. Like
okay.
On Tuesday, you've got an interview scheduled that you're going to be doing with NPR, right?
Well, it's PRI, and I think that's public. I don't know what that stands for. PRI.
Public Radio International or something. Okay.
Yeah. They're some kind of an affiliate of NPR, or NPR carries their programs. And the author of that article in the Seattle Stranger, Jen Graves, was on the program last Saturday on Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
She was discussing the controversy over me with Tim Detweiler, who was a art museum curator here in Seattle. The producer or some engineer or somebody there wrote me an email asking if I'd like to come back and explain myself. Mm-hmm. They wanted to give me an opportunity to talk. So I said, yes, I would. And Tuesday, if all goes well, I'll be taped for a future show. And I can't say when that show will be, but they extended the invitation for me to speak.
Right. And as you know, when they're going to interview you and tape it, and then they're going to cut it, is they're going to do a longer interview than the time they have to put it on the air, right? That's generally the way they do. So then they themselves are going to edit it without giving you the right to say okay or not as to what they do. So, you know, I would be, you want to do it anyway because you think it's, you know, a good idea. But, you know, they will not probably be very fair to you. You never know.
No, I know. I mean, I don't hold out any hope for convincing anybody that I'm not bad as they're making me out to be. I mean, mm-hmm. It's all going to be negative, but I may be able to slip in some comments that would maybe lead some people to look a little bit deeper into the issue. You know, smart people.
Yeah, really. Well, we hope this is what's going to come from this. I mean, I do. I'm not saying that we're in league, or I don't want to give the impression that, you know, we're conspiring or that I'm in on any of this or that I'm, you know, none of that. This just happened with you based on things you've said and your fame. I shouldn't say notoriety. You have notoriety now, but, you know, you're the fact of your prominence in the art world. So, you know, I was thinking, I'll just throw this in now while I think about it. I was thinking this morning, you know, reading a lot of things about you. I should get back into art and do Holocaust art. But then I realized real quick that it wouldn't make a bit of difference. Nobody would care. It's the fact it has to be an established artist, you know, who's already got a reputation and everybody looks up to and so on. Say some of the things, you know, that they've discovered you have said, and that then it would make a difference. But if somebody who doesn't have a reputation started doing it, it wouldn't make any difference at all.
Well, you probably get a little bit of publicity just for its reactionary-ness.
Well, I don't know who'd even pay attention to it, see. So well, that's why I say you're a man of destiny, because you have established this very, very good and prominent, and some people call you renowned. Some of these statements, you know, I'm really impressed with them. You know,
excuse me for interrupting, but
yeah.
They've blown me up so that they can knock me off my pedestal. I was never that renowned. I mean, and it's all hyperbolic. They're blowing me up so that they can, you know, tear me down.
Yeah, to make it more important. I thought so too, but you know, yeah. I don't. But anyway, you know, in the art world, you never know. They're always hyperbolic and they're always, you know, praising people or, you know, criticizing people and so on. But what's the most interesting part of this, I think, and we'll talk about this as we go on, is that several people have made it very clear that it's about, whether your personal views should affect how people see your art, you know, should change the way they see your art. And this is really a deep and important consideration in the art world. And there's a lot to say about it. But anyway, so you're going to be doing this interview with Kirk Anderson. And, I didn't finish saying that, the man of destiny, because you have become a recognized artist in, you know, all over the United States, not just on the West Coast and probably some places around the world. And then for this to happen, you know, it puts it in the news. It makes people really pay attention. And there's not too many people that could have ever happened to, you know. But you're the one, you know, and I think, of course, the more that I would praise you, the more that people who are, our enemies that are listening, that will listen to this, will only use it against you. So I should be careful, because I don't want to make people, I don't want to give people any. Phone is ringing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to give people any reason to, make things worse for you than they are. But then again, this is what brings it all out. So let me continue. I'm babbling a little bit here. Then now the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, just on March 6th published, that's 3 days ago, published a hate watch piece on you.
Something's going on with my phone.
Can you turn?
Yeah, I got it off. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Bait and switch. So just 3 days ago, they published this hate piece on you. And then Salon, which is a super ultra leftist, as far as I'm concerned, along with Huffington Post, they picked up that SPLC
right,
and published it on their site. And, you know, you want to talk about that? It was not a bad write-up.
Well, I got a nice write-up in 2002 in Salon, which was very favorable about my work. And that's when this idea about irony and satire in my work was introduced,
mm-hmm,
by a journalist named Doug Cruikshank. He did a really bang-up job of interpreting what I was doing, and he spent a long time talking to me, and he's a good writer. So he was being a freelancer for Salon, and that was a very nice feather in my beret up until now. So the fact that Salon reprinted SPLC's Hate Watch article is kind of interesting, because of what SPLC is, and then why would Salon think that? Why does Salon think they're important? And I don't know what else to say about it other than I was sort of surprised that Salon doesn't have their own writers covering this. They're just like picking it up off the wire, let's say.
Well, maybe it satisfied them. Maybe they didn't even want to do that for you. They didn't even want to write it. I don't know. I don't know, but I don't think very much of Salon. Now, yeah, back then they wrote a nice something up nice about you, because they didn't see you in the way that people are being encouraged to see you now.
Right.
You know, so that could make the big difference there.
I was surprised about the guy that wrote the article, Bill Mullen, I think his name is. He messaged me on my Facebook timeline and told me that there was going to be an article, and I wasn't asked for a comment, but I sent some comments back to him that I had prepared for another, not an interviewer, but another person that was preparing an article that had sent some questions. And Bill Mullen included the questions. The answers to those questions that I'd answered for somebody else, and he wove them into the story that he prepared for SPLC's Hate Watch. Then he said, he messaged me after he had posted it and said, "We used all your words," which I thought was kind of generous, because I got a few licks in there about the difference between revisionism, Holocaust revisionism, skepticism, and denial. I didn't explain them, but I presented them, and then I said there's differences between white nationalism and white supremacy, and I didn't go into those differences, but at least I got to say that I thought there were differences.
Yeah, so, well, I find that some of these outwardly, of course, SPLC says they're not Jewish, but these outwardly Jewish sites and papers are often more fair than the ones who pretend they're not Jewish, but really are trying to sort of please the Jews who hire them. They're much more hysterical about things.
Well, because I had prepared those answers for the Jewish Daily Forward. So I had those ready, and this fellow at that paper named Menachem somebody, I can't remember his last name, he included those too. I thought that was generous. I'm saying that I'm surprised that I'm not being censored.
Maybe you have some people who like you. there's probably quite a lot of people out there who like you. In fact, we will come up upon a few of them. That brings me to say whatever else you want to say, but also then tell us how you're handling all this publicity, with dealing with, just in general and dealing with your friends. I mean, it first came out when you were in India still, and you're kind of shocked by it. And you were able to not have to say anything because you're out of the country. It gave you some time to, gave you before you had to speak about it.
The infrastructure in India where I was is pretty poor, so I couldn't download things like PDFs and such, and there was no possible way that I could there was Skyping going on, but you never know in India when the system's going to crash or it's going to get weak. So I couldn't really communicate, and I thought it was best just to remain quiet about the whole business, because I didn't realize that this story was gonna
keep going to
grow legs and go global, which it's done. So I just thought it was going to be an issue in my community. And I was watching the back and forth in the comments section of the stranger's blog. It generated, I think, 275 comments,
mm-hmm.
which were some of them are good, some of them are silly, some of them are,
it got into a lot of commenters arguing with each other over things.
Yeah.
It always happens when there's a whole lot of comments, you know.
Right. The thread gets polluted, they can't stay on topic, it gets all over the place. But anyway, that's when I got back, I started getting these messages and emails from other newspaper blogs, I guess, online blogs for newspapers. And so I thought, well, should I just remain silent and just let this thing work itself out without me saying any more about it? I was advised to just keep quiet. But then I decided, now I'll answer everybody's questions. So that's where I am now.
All right. And so you've got other things, other people want to have you on, but you did hold off with some of them so you could be on with me first. And I appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
And you said you're having a little bit of trouble with friends. You had lot of friends who are unhappy and upset.
Yes, I have a lot of old, not a lot, but some old friends that I've had since I was young are concerned. They've seen the news and somehow been appraised of the controversy in Seattle, and so I'm getting emails from them. They say it isn't true, exclamation point. And then they'll send me a hyperlink to one of these articles. And so I've had to kind of take time out to try to explain myself to them. And that's taken up some time this week. I'm kind of hurt by the social stigma that's now been attached to me. It's kind of painful. Mm-hmm. I don't care about the public arena. I don't know a lot of the people that are involved in arguing, you know, the back and forth about what they think I am and what they think I'm doing. But these people that I've known all my life that are upset with these revelations, which aren't really revelations at all, that's hurtful when they are wagging their fingers at me and accusing me of being repellent. You know, I've been told that now I'm a repellent person.
Yeah, there has been a lot of that. I'll point some of that out as we go along. You know, what about the damage to your reputation? You've been an artist all these years. You've built up this reputation. And right off the bat, the idea was kind of like, well, you know, they want to ruin his reputation. They want it like they do with the owl people. You know, they want to have his work not shown in the galleries or in the museums that already own them and things like that. How do you think? Go ahead.
Jen Graves in the Premier article wrote that I'd been dropped by a Seattle resale gallery, which is a gallery that sells art that had belonged to somebody else before. It's a, you want to get rid of a painting or a sculpture, you bought it previously.
Hey, Charles, let me just interrupt you for a second. Somebody's trying to call in from 508 area code. Callers, I said in the beginning we can only take calls in the second hour, and we can't take any calls in the first hour. It kind of messes up our system for once we go to the break. So please hang up and call back after we get going in the second hour. Thanks. Okay, go ahead, Charles.
Okay, well, she wrote that this gallery in Seattle had dropped me, and she also wrote that a gallery in Texas had dropped me. And the Seattle gallery, they've dropped me. But the Texas gallery, they didn't tell me that I've been dropped. So if I don't hear from these gallery owners that have my work, then I assume I'm still being represented by them. Nobody that runs an art gallery that handles my work has written me a letter, an official letter saying we're no longer handling your work.
But this one did? This one has dropped? Oh, I didn't know. So you've already been dropped by one gallery.
Well, this is a resale gallery.
Resale. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. That call kind of destroyed
that
my attention.
That it's not any work that mine that mm-hmm. they're handling. It's other people's work.
Well, that's good then. That's good. You know, these art people are not going to immediately jump to conclusions about this. And it looks... As there are indications that the tide is turning, at least with some people. So if you have anything more to say about dealing with it, then I want to go into your history, but I want to give you a chance with...
Well, listen, Carolyn, they've been these other people that have picked the story up have been collecting comments from people beyond Seattle that knew about me. I had a dealer in New York City, and he's been polled, you know, and he doesn't have a gallery any longer, but he came out and said that I'm what I stand for, or what I'm saying is reprehensible. So.
Well, sure. And, you know, I kind of hesitate to ask you this, but how many of these people in the art world that you deal with are Jewish? Or not so many?
Not so many, no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this particular fellow, he's not Jewish.
Okay. All right. But see, and that's it, because these other people, and I was, you know, when you couldn't come on Saturday before? I did the first half, you know, of the show talking about some of these things and what people had been saying. And you find that a lot of these non-Jewish people are just worse than Jewish people getting all upset about this, you know.
I've been getting emails from Jewish people in support of, you know, supporting me. It's been really interesting. Fan mail. Believe it or not.
Well, that's good. Right. They're probably sincere, but I would say they also might not want to be seen as destroying your career over something like this. But they might, but that doesn't mean they're not sincere.
They appear sincere to me. I mean, they're applauding my iconoclasm.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, let's talk about your iconoclasm. I mean, a little bit of history on you. Somewhere it's written, the oldest promising young artist in Seattle, that's what they called you, the oldest promising young artist in Seattle, labored in obscurity in Seattle as a writer and painter, this was way back, for years before achieving success as a ceramicist. And it says that you broke into ceramics after accepting a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Citizens Exchange Council, and the Soros Foundation. To travel to former Yugoslavia to observe the after effects of the Balkan War. You can find this actually on Wikipedia, but that's not where I got this. But I found the same thing there. Tell us a little bit about that, Charles. What year was this? And tell us about how you got these endowments in the Soros Foundation.
That was one grant. Citizens Exchange Council, CEC Arts Link is a funding organization in New York City that puts Eastern European artists together with American artists. They send Americans to Eastern Europe for collaborative projects and bring Eastern Europeans to America for collaborative projects. So I applied for some money to go to Slovenia and work with a group there called NSK. Neue Slovenische Kunst means New Slovene Art. And they're a collective, and they gave me. I got two grants actually from them on alternative years. It was just enough money to pay for the airfare, and there and back. So it wasn't a big grant, but I ended up in Sarajevo during the. War in Yugoslavia at the tail end of the war in 1994 with the band Liebach, and I was by default I became their tour photographer for that particular concert series of concerts that they presented in Sarajevo, and while we were there, the Dayton Peace Accords were announced in Dayton, Ohio, so the war actually officially ended one of the nights that we were presenting a free concert in Sarajevo.
And did your work with them have anything to do with your ceramic work, or is that two separate things?
I had already started my drifting into ceramics before I got together with NSK, but and my proposal to the Arts Link people was to go to Slovenia and make some plates for this collective, some dinner plates. And
had you made plates before that?
Yeah, I started to paint on plates. I took a china painting class from these little old ladies in town because I wanted to learn how to paint on china. I didn't know how to do it, and so I had a really good time with these, you know, this little. A club of china painters. It's a hobby craft, and they brought me into their circle, and I spent a winter learning how to paint on ceramic surfaces. But I wanted to say that with the NSK group, they were always playing with political tropes, Nazi imagery, Catholic imagery, and Soviet socialist realism. They were mixing it all up, and that's when I got kind of infected by the idea of using political symbols in my artwork. I was apolitical when I left for Slovenia in 1994, and I came back kind of politicized.
Okay, so did you start the disaster where in Slovenia? Was that?
No, I started that in Seattle.
Okay, because it says it debuted in 1991 at the Davidson Gallery.
They did.
And that was before you went to Slovenia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I started painting pictures of plates. Do you know what the word trompe l'oeil means? It means fools the eye in French. And I was doing paintings of plates with pictures of disasters on them. And then I decided, well, I could actually make the plate itself rather than paint a picture of it. So I went from painting pictures of plates as realistically as I could to actually fabricating these plates with disaster designs on them.
Right. And when did you start making your own plates? Because it sounds like in the beginning, they said you bought a bunch of plates in Slovenia to paint on and then put in the kiln.
No,
right?
I designed. Yeah, well, I mean, we got a hold of some plates, and I created ceramic transfers there that can be applied to plates. So I wasn't hand painting every plate. I made decals.
Yeah.
You have ceramic decals that you can fire into the plates, and so.
Can you buy those? And then, but then you learn to make your own, or I never, you know, I read that. I don't understand.
You can buy them from decal companies that supply ceramists, or. Now they've got this new technology where you can design your own.
And that's what you do.
I do a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I've designed my own, and then I've also used commercial transfers in odd ways, like collaging them together in odd ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Then they say in Slovenia you're already doing these things that featured grotesque and violent images, including people being butchered in their sleep and ceramic hand grenades. Well, I think I saw those ones of people being butchered in their sleep. They weren't that bad. They were kind of old detective
Exactly. I did a series of noir scenes, noir movies, and there was one of a man sleeping that was going to be clubbed.
Yeah, right.
I did one of those. It's not like I did a bunch of them.
Yeah, right. Okay, you know, and by the way, you know, I fail to say, people, to see all of Charles' work, or at least a lot of it, you go to charlescraft.com, and it's a real nice site, and once you figure out how to maneuver there, you'll be able to look at everything. It's quite interesting. I was doing that yesterday.
That's a work in progress. It's not finished yet. I started it before I left for India, and I hope to be able to finish it now that I'm back.
Okay. Well, you know, I like it better than your Via Delirium site.
Oh, well, that belongs to somebody else. I mean, that isn't me, and that's cobbled onto somebody else that built that site about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
It's updated.
So this is your first real site of your own that you've created. That's beautiful.
Yes.
Very well done. Very tasteful.
I had help with that because I'm not very savvy with computers, so I have a friend of mine has been doing that for me, helping me.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. But, you know, it has a real nice look to it. Okay, so then it says that you returned to the Pacific Northwest. And you were, I don't know what year this was, and you were commissioned by the estate of Sinclair Lewis and Dorothy Thompson to create a series of plates commemorating their tragic relationship.
Yep, that's true.
That? For permanent display, so where are they displayed?
At the, there's a bed and breakfast that somebody has created where Dorothy Thompson and Sinclair Lewis lived. And I think it's called the, Sinclair Lewis House or something. I can't quite remember, but okay. They got in touch with me and asked me to commemorate their relationship, a series of plates that are hanging in this bed and breakfast now.
Okay, and then this work was seen as successful, and led you to have a one man exhibit at Garth Clark Gallery in New York.
Now that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So everybody always wants to get their work seen in New York.
Well, now listen, this was a ceramic gallery, and ceramics and the fine arts are two different things. We're relegated to the crafts, pretty much. We had been up until recently. Now there's a big kind of a multimedia umbrella, and art students are getting are encouraged to work in a variety of mediums. But
well, you kind of broke through that, didn't you? And your work started being seen as not ceramics, but as art.
Yes, I did, but at the same time, I wanted to. If I painted a picture of a plate, I could get five times more for the painting than I could for an actual plate.
Really?
Yeah, because the crafts were relegated to another kind of price range. Believe it or not.
Well, did people want to buy a painting of a plate as much as they'd want to buy the plate?
They did when I was a painter. Whatever
really?
I paint, you know.
Uh-huh.
When I first exhibited this disaster where I had a half a room, half a gallery full of paintings of plates, and then the other half of the wall space was devoted to the plates I had made. So I had two things going there at the Davidson Gallery when I launched Disasterware. And then I just dropped painting entirely because I was having so much fun with this new medium. It revitalized my interest in art. And then going to Slovenia and participating with this NSK group taught me that art can be almost like the sort of relief that the Red Cross brings to cultures under duress, because these woebegone Bosnians were starved for any kind of outside diversion. They had been under siege for 4 years, and it was a war situation, so people were going to Sarajevo and presenting art and plays and music concerts, anything to keep the spirit of those beleaguered folks up, you know, and to be connected culturally with the outside world was very important, and was like cultural relief that we were offering, and I was really proud to be a part of that, because I hadn't realized that there is something more than just this, art being a commodity, a status symbol for the people that can afford it. I actually saw art in action helping people in a traumatized community. So
that's what the left wingers are supposed to want to do. So they shouldn't be criticizing you. But anyway, now going to your, you said often enough that your two main inspirations in art were Morris Graves, and he did do beautiful work, and Von Dutch, somebody very different, a motorcycle and hot rod signer, one of those people that decorate these things, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when I was a kid, I built model cars, and I was aware of Von Dutch's reputation as a pinstriper and a motorcycle builder and a hot rod maker through the magazines, the hot rod magazines. And I go pick them up at the drugstore to get ideas for my models. When I became an artist, an exhibiting, professional salon painter, I thought, well, whatever happened to Von Dutch? Because I sort of abandoned him as I went from, you know, being a preteen into almost a middle-aged artist. I tracked him down and I wrote him a letter thanking him for putting me on the path that I'd taken, a professional artist. And he wrote me back, and we started a correspondence, and it lasted about 2 years until he died. And I actually got a chance to meet him right 2 months before he died. And
oh, that's great.
Graves was also a personal friend of mine. What's nice about having these, I didn't go to art school, by the way, so these guys sort of were my mentors, but they didn't really teach me because I wasn't in school. I was just inspired by them, and I was inspired by their lifestyles too. So I got a chance to have them as personal friends before they
both they both had a strong spiritual quality, didn't they?
Yeah, and they were both hermits. That's another thing about these two guys. They did not like to be in the spotlight. They were famous, but they hid from publicity.
Yeah. And well, you've never sought out publicity, but you have it now.
I got more than I need right now.
Okay, now, one last thing before we go into some of these articles about you. In one of your videos, you make a point to criticize artists. I'll criticize is the word I use. Who don't take responsibility for their content and say that it's up to the viewer to decide. And I agree that that's a cop-out. I know what you're talking about. A lot of them say that, and even art critics will say that too. But you don't agree with that, and you want to elaborate on that any, because that's going to come up a lot in what some of these articles about you are about.
Well, there was this. I just wanted to admit to the camera that I knew that I was pushing buttons, because some artists will say, well, I have no control over the reaction that my artwork is provoking in the greater arena. But because I was dealing with this, like swastikas and some of this other Third Reich imagery, and then disasters and political catastrophes, I knew exactly that the reaction was going to probably be strong. So that's what I'm saying. I'm cognizant of the power of these symbols.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That was all I was saying at the time. I was involved in behind the scenes revisionist research, but I'd never really admitted to being a Holocaust revisionist or Holocaust denier. It was about my art. It wasn't about my research. And that's what has happened, is that they're more concerned about the fact that I was researching this stuff than they were back when I made that statement. So
you think that your research was the main influence on you incorporating these symbols into your art? Because,
no.
And tell us when you first started that, because you've got Hitler images, you've got SS images, you've got swastika images, and what else? There's just a few, and it's not everywhere. You've got bombers over Dresden, but that's
right.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, I began with natural catastrophes, earthquakes, fires, and floods, and then I drifted into socio-political catastrophes, and I sort of got stuck on the German World War II stuff. And I should probably say that over the course of my 40 years as an artist, the Third Reich imagery is just a tiny fraction of what I've done. So they've zeroed in on this to pillory me. But if you look at the overall production throughout my career, the stuff that has Third Reich imagery in it is very small compared to the rest of it.
Yeah, well, let me say that, they probably would never have done it if they hadn't. If there wasn't stuff on your Facebook page first, and that people, and then people wrote to this Jen Graves and, said, what's up with Charles Kraft? And then she found the White Network program. She started looking on the, and so I'm surprised nobody found it before this,
They
were never motivated to look for anything like this.
I got a Facebook message from a college teacher in Seattle who said, I'm surprised that you haven't been outed by the arts community for your bigotry. Mm-hmm. And I wrote her back and I said, well, if you think that I should be outed, why don't you do it?
Oh, Charles. And all this is openly on your Facebook page. See, I'm not a Facebook member. I'm stubborn. And so I can't get onto any of these pages.
Well,
and
so
I don't know.
Well, this person apparently wrote an anonymous letter to that Jen Graves and said, are you aware of, Charles Kraft and some of the things that he's been saying on his Facebook page? And then I got this letter from her, from Jen Graves, saying, you've been accused of being a Holocaust denier. What do you say about that? And I said, unless you have some art that you'd like me to help you explain, I don't think I want to answer that loaded question, because whoever has presented it to you to ask me doesn't have my best interests in mind. And I'd rather, you know, not say one way or the other what I am. She came back and said, well, I'm going to write about you anyway, so you might as well make a statement. That was essentially what happened 4 months later. I'm going to go ahead and I found a bunch of stuff that you've left all over the internet at different sites and things you've said, and you're going to be outed. And if you have something to say, you might as well say it now.
Well, that's why I say, I use that term man of destiny, because, you know, you didn't intend to do this, but because you're always honest, because you're always saying what you think, like you told this person on Facebook, well, if you have something to say, just go ahead and say it. And so that made him a little bit mad and say, oh, I will, you know. So all this happens because of the person that you are. And now you're in this position, which is, to some of us, a very good position, and to, you know, others would look like your old friends who look at your interests differently, would think a very bad position, but there you are. So we have that. Okay, go ahead.
I wrote you an email. I don't know if you got it yesterday
about Elsa. Talk about that.
Okay, well, Elsa drew a lot of attention to my timeline on Facebook, because she was always attacking posters there and doing it in a very crude way. And what started to happen was people began to confuse me and Elsa, and also thinking that Elsa might be a sock puppet that I was using to be a crude gutter anti-Semite, because Elsa's language was really...
Why did you leave Elsa on there? Why did you allow Elsa to do that?
Because I didn't want to be censorious. I kept telling these friends of mine that were advising me to block her, that I didn't want to be the kind of person that, you know, blocks people. You know,
some people need to be blocked.
Well, I was
now, who do you know who this Elsa is? Because you said do you know for sure, or you just suspect?
No, I know for sure, because I used to go and she had a blog before they censored it, and it was a pretty interesting blog, and it was the intellectual content I thought was above average. And
I know who, and I know who she is, and I'm not sure if it's a she or a he. I always thought this person was a she, got that in my head early on. But because this is the person that signed themselves Brian Akira.
Right.
Right. And I used to get emails from him all the time. And a lot of them were also sent to you. You know, she had you on her list. And she got real mad at me a few times because I wouldn't go along with her and wouldn't post her stuff. And I haven't heard from this person in a long, long time. I'm surprised, because she always came back. Do you think it's a he or a she?
It's a he.
Oh, it is a he. Okay. Because people all told me it was he.
It's a he, and he made a conscious decision to infuriate the watchdogs at Facebook and Yahoo and wherever this censorship is being done. So he's gone way out of his way to be offensive. And that's what he was doing on my Facebook page, and people didn't like it, and people thought that I was bad because I was allowing it to happen.
Like you agreed with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's where you did kind of make a mistake there. You know, I quit publishing any of his stuff at the White Network, because he's just so vicious and goes after people in such a terrible way.
Yeah, he's vile. I mean, but this is a conscious decision to attract attention from the censors.
Well, there again is your destiny. Maybe, you know, it's something in you just made you make these decisions that you've made and has led you to where you are. Because I think this played a big part, these messages on Facebook, in bringing all this stuff out about you out to the surface.
Right.
Yeah. So it's this guy and being on the White Network and saying that you thought the Holocaust was a myth. And then people were shocked out of their mind for anybody to say such a thing, you know. And so I think that the New York Daily News article, which just appeared Tuesday, March 5th, it's one of the newer ones, written by Sasha Goldstein, is one of the better ones, actually. Again, you know, a Jewish paper, a Jewish writer, did a pretty good job of writing you up. And they do also bring out the White Network quite a bit. And I pointed that out to Tan, I think, just yesterday, and he was quite impressed. He likes that. And because in the caption to the very nice photograph they published of your canisters, your biological warfare canisters, they call them, they make in these bold letters here, they say on the white, you were featured in July on a podcast titled Should White Nationalists Leave the Holocaust Alone on the White Network, a website featuring whites talking to whites about white interests. You know, and that's all supposed to be quite damning. But he pointed out to me, too, that they capitalize white in the White Network. But when they quoted, and they put it in quote marks because it's, you know, underneath, it's on our top of our web front page, whites talking to whites about white interests. We have, of course, the word white capitalized, and they put it in lower letters. And oh. Pam thought that was really interesting because they, you know, it is a quote, but they changed it because they just couldn't stand, he says, to have white being capitalized.
Well, he's probably right.
Yeah, because you find all over that when they never capitalize white, but no. They will capitalize all the other
ethnicities, right?
Yes,
everybody else gets a capital letter except us.
Yeah. And even many times I've seen, not many, but a few times I've seen white nationalists being used, and they won't capitalize that either. We always capitalize white nationalism. I mean, most people do. You know, it's a kind of a name of something. But they take those caps off because, you know, and that's a big psychological thing is to, if you capitalize a word, how important it is.
Right.
And they get real upset if you don't capitalize the word Jew. You know, anybody who writes and doesn't capitalize Jew, they think that's real insulting you know, shows that you're anti-Semite and so on.
Also, listen, Carolyn, you have to capitalize Holocaust. That's always a capital.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I often don't, and because I either put it in quotes or I, but if it's, I'm, you know, kind of quoting what other people are saying, then I don't capitalize it either. So, you know, we all do this. We're all playing this little game. Anyway, they start out saying, this person who wrote it, the revelation of all this that I just said, that you were on this podcast and you said these things, has shaken the art world. Which interpreted Kraft's artwork as in an ironic way, and then says that it, quote, if you were, who said this? Somebody said this. If you were a Nazi, oh, Tim Detweiler said this. They're quoting him. If you were a Nazi sympathizer and selling Hitler paraphernalia by the side of the road, you'd be killed, they said. He said, would you? Huh? I don't know. Depending on where you are. He is a former director of the Museum of Northwest Art. And he then said, quote, but he's selling it at the highest price stores and at galleries all over the country, unquote. So, you know, you're getting away with something here.
I'm not selling Hitler memorabilia. I'm selling art. So, and he should qualify the statement that he made. Let me qualify it for him. I mean, what I'm doing is that It's a little bit more than just memorabilia and regalia, you know.
It's Tim Detweiler. Did you know him? And now he's no longer the director, but do you consider him to be working against you here?
Yeah, I consider him working. Yeah, he's working against me in the back and forth that's going on around me. I know him slightly, and we'd had some nice conversations about local art. He used to be the head of a foundation that was erected for a black sculptor in Seattle that was pretty famous, named James Washington Jr., who was part of the Northwest School. And Detweiler, they took Washington's house and turned it into a kind of a shrine, you know, to his career. It's a nonprofit organization that is visited by school kids and others that are interested in his legacy. And Detweiler was the head of that foundation. So that's how I first became aware of him, because he had invited me to come by and see what they were doing. And then he got the job up in Museum of Northwest Art. And now I guess he's not there anymore. But before this happened, we were on speaking terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. I'm sure. This has changed. We'll talk about that when we get back from the break, which is coming up. Because a lot of people feel that this just changes everything in their relationship to you and in the way they think about your art. And others say that it shouldn't be that way. And I think this is a really interesting topic for discussion. So we'll do that as soon as we get back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and my guest is Charles Kraft. We're talking about his the big furor over his art and being his thoughts about Holocaust. And when we get back, you can call in at 1-833-443-4911. We'll see you in 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager, and my guest is Charles Kraft, and we're going to just move right along here. Charles, you made a statement to the Daily News. They say that you wrote in an email to them that you, that you have admitted to being a Holocaust skeptic and use the word skeptic and identifying as a WASP on a white nationalist website. But you want to say that you point out that you never tried to dupe any collectors or curators with your irony while laughing at them, which you've been accused of doing, you know, laughing behind their backs, and that you arrived at your controversial opinions on race and World War II history only relatively recently. And then you say that, as you've already said here, that, you know, over 40 years of your career, you had very little Nazi symbolism. And that you all also said earlier in the program that you wanted to point out the differences, crucial differences between Holocaust denial, Holocaust skepticism, and Holocaust revisionism, and also between white supremacy and white nationalism. And then you explained about your research into the Romanian Archbishop Viorel Trifa, which we can go into after you respond to these earlier things here. So what would you like to say? What is your position? How do you define yourself in both those categories of Holocaust beliefs and white nationalist type or white beliefs about the white race, or what do we call that? You used the word for it last night, and that's the word that...
Advocacy.
Advocacy, yeah, white advocacy, that kind of thing.
Well, as far as the... defining myself under the umbrella term white nationalism, I would put myself as an advocacy for white tradition. I've identified as a WASP, but I've been told that I can't be a WASP because I'm not an Anglo-Saxon. But when I was growing up, WASP was a term for white Protestants. And I was
well,
born
that's right. And you have, you know, you're German. You're probably mostly German ancestry, at least your father. Your name is, you still spell your name with the two F's, which is nice. And that's just another mark against you, probably, to these people. Well, no wonder he's been this way all his life. He's a German.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, white nationalism hasn't really been defined, and there are people that are, racially aware who are white that don't like the term because it's too close to white supremacy or white power. And nationalism itself is not a very, it's got negative connotations now because of the global the mandate for a global society, right? So anything that's right. Nationalistic is looked upon as askance. Mm. So from what I've been able to glean from the white nationalist websites, I guess, and the the organizations that are pro-white, not everybody is comfortable with that term, and some people are looking for a softer way to define themselves so that it doesn't attract such negative reactions from people who might not understand that white nationalists aren't necessarily white supremacists.
Well, no, not at all. And they're always saying that, but they don't care because in the media, they always call anybody that's pro-white a white supremacist.
Yeah, no, that's terrible. I mean, I'm trying to get the point across that who wants to be saddled with the responsibility of reigning supreme over anybody else? We just like to be... ourselves and not be saddled with a bunch of guilt for everything in the world that went wrong, according to the opposition, I guess.
Yeah, you know, in this, it's way up here. I won't find it. But, you know, the article that was in the, I almost got it, hyperallergic.com. Hyperallergic.com is some kind of a blog type thing. And
right.
There's an article written by Julian Steinhauer. And she was talking with Jen Graves, and they are both very much, you know, upset about you and against you. And they made the point, she says, Graves and I agreed that at the end of the day, you know, you were not as interesting as the larger issues. They're trying to put you down. The larger issues raised here are exiling a person is a way of pretending that the whole society's not infected. They're saying that, you know, even if they get rid of you or your influence or your art or whatever, the whole society is infected. And they say that you, Charles, comes from a backlash to multiculturalism that they're seeing all over the place out here. So they don't want this backlash to multiculturalism. They love multiculturalism, and they want it to stay. And they said further that any country that's perpetuated and grappled with as many ridiculous myths and conspiracy theories surrounding its president as we have in the past 5 years is battling some serious demons. So they are supporters of our president in the last 5 years, Barack Obama, and they call anything against him ridiculous myths and conspiracy theories, and that this is serious demons in our society. So, you know, if you just say that, you know, we don't want to be supreme over anybody, we just want to have our own society in our own way, in, you know, white society and with white cultural values and so on, they see that as something demonic, you know, that's not allowable. So we're dealing with, they think they're dealing with problem. We're dealing with this, you know, with the problem too, with these people.
Yeah, we certainly are, because I think that the agenda of those people is race replacement.
Okay, so yeah, see, and the fact that you are saying things like this makes you a white nationalist in their eyes. So there you are. You're not going to get out from under that.
No.
So talking about your let's talk about how you see a Holocaust and Holocaust, the various forms of how people approach the Holocaust. It's not just one thing or the other.
Well, the media will call anybody that's skeptical about the received history of the Holocaust a Holocaust denier. When somebody sees that in the newspaper or on a blog or something, they assume that this person is denying that there was any camps or the whole thing, you know, the whole story we're denying. Well, that's not true at all. I've learned from this controversy that this is the case with people when they see that term Holocaust denier, which is a weaponized term that has been created to make anybody that's skeptical look crazy. And then I have to tell them, well, no, we know that there was a Holocaust, but we have doubts about certain parts of the received history of it.
Well, the you know, my position, I'll just state it here because I don't want to appear like I'm agreeing with that. My position is that the Holocaust is the wrong word, and so I am a Holocaust denier, certainly in that sense, because there wasn't a Holocaust, but there was a program to remove Jewish influence first from Germany and then to remove Jews from Germany. And that is totally unacceptable. Both of them are to Jews. I mean, and to the people who are on their side, to, you know, left wing and so on. Because, you know, if you remove Jewish influence, well, then that's just as bad to them as to remove them altogether. Because they have to have their influence in order, if they think, to, you know, protect themselves or feel safe or secure or whatever. So the whole thing is, you know, I mean, the whole terminology is wrong. And what word are you comfortable with? How would you describe yourself in relation to?
I like skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, because I'm just because it you know, I'm more comfortable with that than a denier. I don't deny that there was a program to remove the Jewish influence and remove the Jews themselves from Germany. I don't believe there was an extermination program. I think
in fact, you said, I guess I read that Did I read that, that you said that
a frog marched into gas chambers.
Yeah, right. And, you know, they just can't handle that because they're afraid that if there's any revision to this Holocaust narrative at all, that the whole thing will come apart. They might not. I don't know what these people, they don't know anything about it, most of these people.
No, that's another thing that I want to mention is nobody that is accusing me of, being a Holocaust denier has really done any homework on the Holocaust. It's amazing. Even reading a exterminationist text, you know, something that like William Goldhagen or Daniel Goldhagen's Hitler's Willing Executioners, which was on the New York Times bestseller list. These people, they don't even read about the Holocaust from the exterminationist perspective. They've just seen movies and they know that they're not supposed to. They just believe what they've.
If they read something like Goldhagen's book, they might start to doubt it because it's such extremist stuff, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, and you know, that the Holocaust industry is churning out books every year, more and more academic tomes about the Holocaust. And I subscribe to the New York Review of Books and the London New York Review of Books and the London Times Book Review. They're always being announced. You know, this a new book by another scholar is being issued by an academic press, university press, about the Holocaust. And none of these people like Jen Graves, who has attacked me for being a denier, I don't think that they've ever really sat down and read much about the Holocaust.
I'm sure they haven't. I'm sure they haven't. They know, most people, they know very little. And when you read the comments, you know that people don't know. Well, I don't want to, I want you to be able to talk about the Romanian Archbishop. So,
okay.
That's where it all started for you. And
right. It was sort of serendipitous. I picked up a Pope paperback about Nazis in America by Howard Bloom. And it was kind of an hysterical piece that wasn't very, accurate. And at the time, though, it was, I guess, being taken rather seriously. And I read one chapter about this archbishop from Romania named Viorel Trifa, who was under investigation for war crimes at that time. And then he was finally charged by the Immigration and Naturalization Services in a civil court for lying about his membership in the Legion of the Archangel Michael when he entered the United States, because they don't want any of these. They asked these immigrants after the war if they'd ever been a member of a fascist or a National Socialist organization, and he said no, and they accused him of lying on his application.
Mm-hmm.
They won't let
you in if you say yes. So if you say no,
yeah, right.
Then later you're going to be accused of lying. So you're pretty well stuck.
Yeah, you're stuck. But for 27 years, this poor guy was just harassed by, the powers that be. And he was caught in this very complex situation where Romania was given trading status, most favored nation trading status, which is something that not every nation gets with the United States. And in order for them to maintain that, they were asked to concoct false evidence against Trifa. And Trifa was convicted or charged. There's no jury in these civil cases, but it came down against him, even though the head of the Romanian Securitate had admitted that they had concocted false evidence against him to feed to Jewish organizations in the United States. Because the deal was, you give us the evidence against Trifa so we can deport him, or you get your most favored nation trading status revoked. And that was the deal that I think it was Ford or somebody gave to Ceausescu, who was the, that dictator there.
President Ford, President Gerald Ford.
One of the presidents, I can't remember, either Nixon or Ford. It was.
Was the OSI involved in this?
Listen to this. This was the guy that they built the OSI around. Elizabeth Holtzman used this case to build the OSI within the Justice Department.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's interesting.
I mean, he was the first John Demjanjuk, you know? Mm-hmm. And she did it. She went after him to get elected to she was running with, Emanuel Sellers? He was a senator, a Jewish senator that was responsible for rolling back the immigration quotas in 1965, opening up immigration to the third world. He was leaving the Senate, and Elizabeth Holtzman wanted his seat. So she used this TRIFA case to whip up a lot of votes in her district, which I think was Brooklyn, New York. And that's how we got the OSI, and that's how the OSI has remained a part of the Justice Department with this huge budget, you know, for those people to go around the world and ferret out these nobodies and charge them with war crimes. I mean, it's ridiculous what they're doing.
Yes, it is. And so it made you really mad. And I know when I first met you, Charles, and I don't know how many years ago it was now, maybe four or something. But you were talking about that a lot. You had said you had this, a mania for Romanians or something like that.
Yeah.
And you
I
were
did.
In the I, midst I, of your, yeah.
Well, it was such a patently vengeful kind of thing that was going on with this guy, Trifa, because he really hadn't had much to do with any atrocities, but they wanted to pin this, you know, these atrocities on him. And they finally succeeded, and his name was constantly in the newspapers being smeared by Walter Winchell and Drew Pearson and all these guys that used to be the big-time columnists back in the day.
And, yeah, they were Jews, too. I don't know about Drew Pearson, but he was a real nasty guy.
Yeah, right, they were. They were part of, you know, kind of like this network of people those
they're
guys
they're against the isolationists
right yeah exactly
yeah and anti-war people and so on
right and then after the war they just became mouthpieces for the powers that be. I mean they would be fed these stories and then they'd regurgitate them and whatever they were told to write they'd write.
So this got you looking into the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, I was sort of, the more I looked into the TRIFA case, the more I found it to be trumped up. And then, lo and behold, Ian Pacepa, this Securitate chief, admits that he's concocted false evidence against TRIFA, and he's feeding it to the United States, you know, Jewish organizations. I don't know what it was in the day, but ADL or somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they were, but it was also TRIFA was also harassed by a dentist named Charles Kramer, who took it upon himself to initiate this letter writing campaign that was just insane. This guy was obsessed with getting TRIFA kicked out of the United States, and he was also making money as he was doing this by asking people to support this fake Romanian American organization that he started because it looked like he was doing a service to the Jewish community, you know, by hounding TRIFA, by trying to get everybody to notice that TRIFA had been a member of the Iron Guard. And this went on for 20 years, this guy, and I just was at the John Jay College of Justice in New York in December. He donated all his papers to after he died to them, and they got lost and they were just found again. And I got the chance to see him, and you can actually watch this little nobody, this little dentist, make a career out of becoming a Jewish community hero by harassing this guy to no end and collecting money and awards along the way until at the end of his life, he was almost like a Simon Wiesenthal character.
I was just going to say, You can compare him to Simon Wiesenthal.
No, I've seen pictures of them together. They're being honored, you know, as the world's greatest Nazi hunters. And they're both frauds. It was a business for these guys. They were collecting money to do this. And they were going after, like I say, absolute nobodies. And they're still going after nobodies. These are just like Eastern European, Ukrainian conscripts, you know, that they just want to pin all this murder on. I mean, to have John Demjanjuk being accused of murdering 25,000 people is a ridiculous charge. Come on.
You know, you seem to have a lot of sympathy for Slavic people, you know, the Romanians, yeah. And then you were with the Slovenians and did all that with them. And where does that come from exactly, or it just happens to be?
It started, you know, I didn't know where Slovenia was, and I just took off for that place because I'd gotten that grant. Once I arrived there, I realized that my whole worldview and historical perspective on World War II was slightly skewed by, you know, the victor's justice and the victor's history that was written after the war. And I went in there being kind of a Yankee Doodle dandy, thinking, wow, you know, I'm G.I. Joe, and my dad was in the war, and we won it, and we're great. I came back, I'm a little bit, I was sort of, not chagrined, but, you know, I began to see it in a different perspective than from a kid, you know, that grew up with American, you know, John Wayne movies and such about the army and the war.
Mm-hmm.
The Slovenes had been divided. They'd been occupied by the Germans, and some of the Slovenes joined the Wehrmacht, and others joined the partisans, Tito's partisans, and so their country was sort of divided. And the guy that my best friend in Slovenia, his father-in-law was an ex-Wehrmacht soldier, so I got a little bit of a lesson about how conscription into the German army happened to some people as the Germans were, you know, moving east. So,
yeah.
And then this business about, I had to learn what the Germans were fighting for. I mean, I didn't really know what it was all about. And so the more I looked into some of the issues about the National Socialism versus Communism, the more I was starting to root for the Germans because I don't like communism, I decided.
Yeah. No, they're nasty. They're the really nasty ones.
They're liars is what they are. Yeah. That's what I think. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I that's true. And but, you know, it's always been that communism has never been seen as bad, except by people who don't like it. But, I mean, in general, the general viewpoint is that, well, they really just wanted to, they went too far, but they just wanted to help the working people. Well, Hitler wanted to help the working people, too. You know, but right. The thing about the communists is they were a universal movement. They wanted to do it everywhere in the world.
Right. And the National Socialism is national, right? It's not universal. It's not global. And nobody seems to understand that. And when everybody talks about Hitler trying to take over the world, I just tear what's left of my hair out, and I don't have much hair, but...
Well, you have plenty of beard you can pull on.
Yeah, no, I mean, the more I looked into the Romania's position between the wars, between World War I and World War II, and what they were fighting against, these nationalistic movements in Eastern Europe, the more I realized that they wanted to preserve their culture. They didn't want the Russian Revolution to leak into their countries and destroy, you know, their traditions, which it did wherever it went.
That's right. Well, do you think that you have will be able to get any of this across to some of these people and a lot of these people if this continues? Well, you've got one interview coming up anyway, to the general public, but then you're not in control of it. They're not going to be able to hear you on that interview live, but all these people in the art world and so on, you know, do you think that you can pass on some of what you have learned and what you understand?
I'm not going to get a platform because we're dealing with cultural Marxism now and the Frankfurt School and this whole agenda that has to do with multicultural global government and global culture. So I don't think anybody's going to let me get on a platform and talk about, Gramsci and do you know about Antonio Gramsci and the slow march to the institutions because he felt that the revolution, the unarmed revolution, wasn't enough, didn't work after World War One. So he came up with this, a cultural revolution. And that's what happened in the 60s. And we're living in the aftermath of the 60s cultural revolution in America, which is, I call it cultural Marxism. And so mm-hmm. do other intellectuals on the right.
Yes.
And
well,
if
they were fair at all, they would have some panels, things on TV, and let you be on there, and maybe somebody, somewhere close to where you're at, and the other people on the other side, and particularly art shows or for talking about how art should be determined. Because let's get into that now about the intentions and reasons, behind anybody's art. So, and how important that is, because this Detweiler is back again in this, PRI podcast. And he says that, this is a quote from him. I see a correlation between Kara Walker's work, and Kara Walker is a black female artist from, I guess she's from Seattle or from the West Coast.
No, she's not. I don't know where she's from, but she's a blue chip artist who's, been given shows all over the United States, which are silhouette cutouts of hyperbolic, exaggerated scenarios, tableaus of slaves and slave masters. Have you seen?
And they're like those black silhouette things, those old fashioned silhouettes.
Yeah, that's an interesting medium that she decided to use. It's cutouts, but the way that she does it, she makes she takes it to a level that's kind of like a Tarantino level, like Quentin Tarantino and how over the top his movies are.
Mm-hmm.
This last one, Django, about revenge, this ex-slave that's on a killing spree, and then before that, the Nazis, the Jews, the Jewish partisans that were killing Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So she—that's what she does. Okay.
Yeah,
well, they all think she's great.
Oh, they love it.
She's making this statement, but your statement is not good. So, but he says I see a correlation between Kara Walker's work and Charles Kraft's work. Artists that use racial imagery. Now you're using racial imagery to draw out this darkness into the light. Fred Wilson and Roger Shimomura, he uses these examples. Are these examples of artists who are drawing, who use racial imagery?
Yeah. Okay. This is, what do they call it? Identity politics in the arts.
Okay. So, and what is their racial imagery about?
Shimomura is very concerned with the internment of the Japanese during World War II. So a lot of his work is about Japanese stereotypes.
Yeah. And that's very politically correct, about the internment of the Japanese.
Kara Walker is all about slavery and the blacks, and Fred Wilson, Fred Wilson's a playwright, is he, or something? Or is that August Wilson? I can't remember. I don't know what Fred Wilson does.
But well, he could be a playwright, yeah. He's supposed to draw this darkness into the light. Okay. And they say Detweiler goes on to say, they have a special burden, all of you artists, you included, that a landscape painter doesn't really have, where their intention and reasons that they do it really make a big difference. He's saying that in your kind of work, your intentions and the reasons why you're doing it makes a big difference, whereas a regular paint, just a ordinary painter doing, pretty scenes, scenes, it doesn't. So they can have whatever kind of politics they want, I guess. If you're a landscape painter, you can be a white nationalist. But if you're doing racially, charged work, then you can't be, because, or it makes a big difference in whether
you can only do, you're only allowed in the art world to do racially charged works if you're from a minority. You can, well, there's nobody, true. There's nobody that's in, that's, doing racially charged works that are pointing out, you know, what's going on with, the population differences and immigration, the impact that this is having on Western culture here and in Europe. I mean, you don't get a chance to talk about that if you're a white person and you're trying to, like, make a statement about, multiculturalism. You understand? It's I'm being excoriated because I'm a white nationalist, quote unquote, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be a white person and talk about whiteness in this arena. You can only talk about being a victim, an ethnic minority that's been victimized by whites. That flies. Right. But something about white pride or white race, you know, race, how the cultures are being, you know, how it's being impacted by third world immigration. This isn't allowed to be discussed or looked at or in the museums, you know.
Well, it's not allowed anywhere, and it goes into the museums because everything is political. You know, it's all politicized. So he's right. and this Detweiler is saying that what you say politically, if you seem to be saying one thing politically, and then you flip that, which they think you've done, but you haven't done anything except it's just that they see you differently now.
Right.
So it's all flipped for them. Then he says a new interpretation has to be taken into account. But then he says at the moment it feels like someone has kicked me in the stomach.
Well, now what are they going to? Yeah, now they're going to go back and post date this my whole career.
That's the question. That's the question.
Or predate it, you know.
But he says, as museum professionals, we have to get some perspective on this, and that's what I hope we can do more and more. So I hope that means that they will continue to look at this, and this should be turned into for the art people. You know, and you being, you know, in the middle of being the reason for all this, and it's about your art. This should be looked at in the art world as to just how they should be looking at artists, because it's what you just said shows that it's very unfair and it's not the way it should be if art is what art is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And there's a little more about that. But you go ahead and comment on that. So, okay, here I've got a question for you. He says, somebody, what is this other thing I'm reading here? From the Globe and Mail. Okay, the Globe and Mail had this thing by Russell Smith, and it was like special to the Globe and Mail. That's Canadian.
Special Toronto.
By Russell Smith. Do you know who Russell Smith is?
No, I have no idea.
I don't either. But anyway, he wrote something that he brought this up. You know, mainly. He says, he's talking about, you know, the thing was titled something about, Monstrous Art or Art About a Monster. Well, the monster being Hitler, you know, not you. A scandal in the art world raises interesting questions about the importance of an artist's intentions. So that's, and then he says that, you know, this article in The Stranger was shocking. He called it a shocking article. You know, about artist Charles Kraft, and known as a dark humorist, you know, for years, known as a dark humorist. And you even called yourself dealing with dark irony or something on your website.
Black humor.
Yeah, right. or dark irony. You called yourself a black humorist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on a video that was made by some students around here that is on YouTube, I was trying to qualify what I was doing as a black comedy in the arts.
Okay, well, he says that up to now, you've been seen as a social critic postmodernist. So that's your category. Social-critic postmodernist, mixing incongruous forms and irreverently making references to the infiltration of the horrific in the cheapest of popular culture. And you were described universally, or Your references to the Second World War have been universally described as anti-fascist, he said. So this is why people are so upset, because they had you categorized one way, and now they're having to face something different. And he said that, told that story about your Hitler Idaho teapot bought by the Jewish patron, and, you know, he didn't, if he knew your real views and so on, that was so unfair to this poor Jewish art collector. And Salon Magazine once said, this has to be the one you were referring to earlier. They said that your pieces, quote, force the viewer to look at mankind's cruelest, most absurd behavior in a way that penetrates the numbness induced by media overload. But while it's not about necessarily mankind's cruelest, most absurd behavior, a lot of it is. Some of it is also about myths that we have that is also need to be that make us dumb, you know, that we're numb to the real history and so on. So this is kind of interesting, and I get to the point here. He says, they talk about you being on the white network and making Holocaust denying statements. And then he says, suddenly all the pieces he has done with Nazi themes take on a troubling resonance. Is the Hitler head teapot a serious commentary on the trivialization of Nazism, or is it just a tasteless joke, or is it in fact a proud flaunting of Nazi affinities? Well, I think you've already answered that, Charles, but I'll say, you know, what would you say to him? What are your intentions?
Well, if the Hitler teapot is ridiculous, don't you think? I mean, how could that be?
It very much.
Well, I like it too.
I have a question about it. That is that I've seen two. I don't know if you have more than that. One, right. Hitler's eyes are open and he's looking very forceful and, you know, like a real, you know, leader and with forceful intentions. And the other one, his eyes are closed and, you know, looks, you could say he was in meditation. You know, he's spiritually in.
I've done a number of different, I do the eyes differently on different, on different teapots. I've got him looking straight ahead at you. I've got him with no eyes like a zombie.
I did see that one too. I don't like that.
That Idaho one where he doesn't have any pupils. And then there's eyes that are looking sideways.
Oh, the one that I think his eyes are closed, is that the one where he's supposed to have no eyes?
That doesn't have any pupils. Yeah, I've never done him with the eyes closed.
Oh, I thought it looked like that's one I had on the announcement. I might use it for the show. I thought it was his eyes were now. I see. I thought his eyes were closed, and it looked quite sweet, you know.
Well, thinks there's holes in the teapot where those eyes should be, but I just didn't paint the pupils in, so. It's kind of like a white-eyed Hitler zombie.
Okay.
And that's, I mean, I don't know why they're going to get upset about that.
So what was why did you do that? That's just a personal, you know, just something you decided to do. It has no meaning.
Yeah, I'm just having fun in my studio looking at this head and thinking, well, now how can I make it different from the last one I made? So I'm riffing on this one form, and it comes out differently every time I do it. Sometimes it has a base. One of the bases said, if Führers were flowers, I'd pick you. And that was.
Well, what was your feeling about Adolf Hitler when you were making his faces on the teapot?
I think Adolf Hitler is, when I was making this, there's been so much heaped on this fellow that I just think of him as a cliche for, you know, for the ultimate evil. And that's the way we're supposed to look at him, like a madman or something. I don't think that at all, but I'm using the image of him as a kind of a cliche for evil when I started out. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of this stuff, you know, I know people put a whole lot of meaning into art beyond that which the artist ever intended. And a lot of artists say, I just did this because I wanted to do it, or I like this or something. They didn't have any big, meaning in that sense, any big idea what it meant. And yet as soon as the gallery people get hold of it, they have to, you know, talk about that. And it grows. So it's, you know.
Well, the idea of a teapot, too, is a little bit, I mean, that's kind of ironical, I thought. And so I don't know. I think that the object itself is not, I mean, people know now that I'm a revisionist and a advocate for white, you know, issues and traditions. Still, the Nazis, a real Nazi, I don't think, would not go for that Hitler teapot. It's a little bit irreverent, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so either. That's not the kind of thing they really want.
No, I don't think anybody would want anything like that in their home. They'd want a regular bust or something that's more heroic looking. This thing kind of looks goofy, ultimately.
Yeah, or it looks repulsive to them because they don't like the face. It makes them think all kinds of bad things. So, so what would you say then about this issue of how important is the artist's political beliefs to the art? And if people find out he has political beliefs different, should that affect? Yeah, you know, I think about Richard Wagner. My God, you know, I mean, he was a known anti-Semite. And he was the greatest composer of operas that ever was, in my opinion, and certainly is arguable. I think he was. And, you know, nobody's going to reject his art. And in time, you know, nobody cares either that much. I mean, he's more famous than most, but in time, the art is there on display. If it's gotten into museums, then there it is. And nobody's asking anymore what this person's political views were. Picasso was a communist all those years, a hardcore communist. Nobody cared about that.
Right.
So they're making this big issue, and I think I really would love to see some good panel discussions and things in the media where it could, you know, the right points could be made, and these people would be hard-pressed to come up with a good answer.
One of the things that happened after World War II was the artists on the right were swept under the carpet. So...
True.
There was nationalistic art movements like the Futurists in Italy, the Vorticists in England with Wyndham Lewis. Ezra Pound was tried for, you know, put away for treason and then released without charges. I mean, just picked up, put in an insane asylum and then let go. Nobody ever, you know, really charged him with anything. So there was a dialogue going on about nationalism before World War II. After the war, anybody that was on the right it has been sort of discredited as being wrong. You know what I mean? Their mm-hmm. ideas. So I'm interested. I was going around trying to find out from museum bookstores and boutiques that sell art museum catalogs, if there is any contemporary right-wing artistic person or movement post-war. What they thought I was talking about was realism. That's what one bookstore owner said. Are you talking about people that paint realistically? I said, no, I'm not. I'm talking about people that have what it would be considered right-wing political views, and they're being, which are being expressed artistically. And he said, well, I can't think of anyone or anybody or anything, any movement. He said, that's a very good question. And I I don't have anything.
He said, no, and they wouldn't be accepted because all the you know, people in authority in the art world.
Right.
Are against that totally.
That's part of this cultural Marxism that we're you know, having to deal with in the arts.
Yeah, let me remind people, we've got 15 minutes left, listeners, and if you want to call in and ask Charles a question and make a brief comment, it's 1-830-443-4911. You can call in now, and while we're seeing if anybody calls, there's two names that were brought up of people who were use Nazi imagery kind of in conjunction with you by this in this Globe and Mail article by Russell Smith. And one was Zbigniew Libera.
Yeah.
Who's done those. And I've seen pictures of those, the Lego models of concentration camps from the Second World War. Then he photographs them to look like an actual Lego product with branding and so on. And right. The other guy is Yael, Israeli artist, Yael Bartana, and he represented Poland at the Venice Biennale. I guess he's Polish Jew, went to Israel. Made a trilogy of dramatic videos about a fictitious Jewish Renaissance movement in Poland. And the second part of it shows Jewish settlers building a kibbutz in Poland, which ends up looking exactly like a walled concentration camp. And they say that this work had troubling connections between Zionism and Nazism. And people who took it literally were outraged. You see how people get politically all worked up over art if it's not done in the way that they think it should be. So what do you say about these two artists?
I was in Budapest, Hungary, and I got a chance to see some of the work of the first artist whose name it's hard for me to pronounce, the Polish guy with the concentration.
Yeah, Libera, though, is his last name.
Libera.
L-I-B-E-R-A.
Yeah, I think that guy's good. I like what he did, and I've seen photographs of the Legos that he actually got the Lego company in Poland, I guess, to create some of these Lego kits. Which have been, by the way, bought by the Jewish Museum in New York City. And I saw that work, and I saw some videos that he'd done and some other...
Well, what do you think his political intentions are as far as the Holocaust?
He said that this was about toys, violence being sort of... his comment about that was violence and children's toys. It wasn't really about Nazis, I don't think. It was part of a whole thing that an exploration of how how children are being prepped to accept violence with their
They think that the concentration camps, that just perpetuates the image that the concentration camps were full of violence. It was all about violence and violating people and so on. So, so he would use that. I wonder if he thought by using a theme connected with the Holocaust, it would, give him more media attention and so on.
I think he might have been aware of that. But one of the other things I noticed in that show I saw that included his work was that he was doing overweight Barbie dolls. So you had the Barbie and she's like, she's overweight, and that was a statement again about how children and toys are part of this indoctrination program that the culture uses to manipulate, thinking.
Well, it says that this Libera has also offended people by meticulously recreating. Now, they're not real photographs. He's recreated some famous 20th century war photographs and recasted them as happy holiday snapshots. And he calls the series positives. And like, for example, one of them shows some healthy young men dressed as death camp survivors, I guess, in those, striped uniforms, posed at a barbed wire fence in an exact replica of a photo from a camp's liberation. And I guess they're happy and healthy and, having a good time like they're on a picnic or something. And this image is deliberately upsetting, like your stuff is upsetting. And he says, he asks, would it be less interesting if the artist went on record saying the art was merely his attempt to show that the Holocaust was a big joke? Huh. They're implying that you're saying it's a big joke, I guess. But anyway, would that make this work less interesting if the guy didn't believe in the Holocaust is what they really mean and thought that the Holocaust was, didn't count? How would you answer that?
Well, Well, I think that this Russ, what's his name? Russell what?
Yeah, Russell Smith.
I think that's one of the more intelligent articles that has appeared, because he's talking about art and everybody else is sort of just talking about politics, right? I don't know how to, he might be doing the same thing I am, and that's maybe demystifying and demythologizing the Holocaust, do you think?
It would be nice to think he was. I'd like to think that, but
I'd like to think so too, but I don't know if he's going to come out and say it, because look what happened to me. He probably doesn't want that kind of grief, especially in Poland where...
So for that reason, he might not see it.
He wants to be more coy. Yeah. They don't have, by the way, you know, these European countries don't have a First Amendment. They can be brought up in jail for this kind of thing. You know, if you're not careful, you could end up like that Holocaust revisionist who was found dead in his car in Poland. You remember him?
His whole
career was shattered because he published a pamphlet that was skeptical about the received history of the Holocaust. He lost his wife, his children, his job, and finally his life. And that's because there's no First Amendment in European constitutions.
Right. Well, Smith, he goes on to say, after he asks that, says, you know, would the art be less interesting if the guy didn't take the Holocaust seriously? So he said, if he thought it was a big joke, and Smith says, say he did, say Kraft does, say you take it as a big joke. Then he says, buyers and admirers of Kraft's art are embarrassed because they gave the work a different interpretation from the artist's own. They don't even know your interpretation exactly. Well, I guess you've kind of given it vaguely, but he said, but since when did the artist's intention count for everything? And this is where he really brings up this question. And he says, since when did an artist's hateful personality, some people are accusing you of having a hateful personality, Charles, even though everybody that knows you says you are one of the nicest, kindest, most helpful human beings they've ever met, now your views are just making you hateful because you have these racist views. So anyway, does this render the work invalid, he's asking. And he says, I added some stuff here, but he says that the first interpretations of Kraft's work as ironic juxtapositions and commentary on popular culture can still be eloquently argued. Interpretations must come from the work itself, not the statements. And then he goes on to say that you're not any good at talking about your own work. Artists hardly ever are. They don't know how to. That's why they're artists, because they can't write and they can't speak. The artist is the last person he'd ask to explain any given work. And then he said, let's ignore Charles Kraft, the person, completely. He's a goof. The art is weirdly powerful, perhaps despite his intentions. Well, you know, I get an idea here that this guy is interested in not paying any more attention to you or this issue, because it's not going to be helpful to his point, you know, to his political persuasion. So they want to say, oh, leave the art alone. The art has nothing to do with Charles Kraft, and we'll go ahead with the interpretation we've always had. And forget about Charles.
I think that's what people should do, because I grew into, you know, these political opinions I have now that are so heretical, right? It took me a decade to get to the point where I could actually admit to publicly admit to being a Holocaust skeptic and an advocate for white, you know, white traditions. So I did start out being ironical. I have a personality that if anybody that knows me will tell you, I've been like this since I was a kid. You know, I'm always kind of a smart aleck. It's a genetic inheritance I got from my parents, who were both very clever and people with a snappy repartee at the dinner table and kind of satirical. Nobody in our family ever really took anything seriously, least of all ourselves. You know what I mean? There was some kind of a built-in bullshit meter that we all have.
Did you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a sister and I have a brother, and we're all the same. And we got it from our mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, what I'm trying to say, they didn't like pomposity. Whenever my mother would get a sense of some person's thinking that they were too self-important, she would crack wise. You know, my parents were wiseacres, and my siblings and myself were wiseacres too. That's the way we grew up.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of that in my family too, but I got most of it, not so much my sister and brother. That's good. That's a good ending statement for you, Charles. And, you know, were some good comments to this person's art, this, Russell Smith's article. And I copied those down. I think I'll just read the last one for you. This is by Merwin. Some of them, you know, thought that your art was no good because your attitudes are no good. But he said that, well, the idea that crafts nationalism and sympathy for revisionism make the works any less ironic is to ironically misunderstand the concept of irony itself. And he says that your work, whether it's about Hitler or the Korean leader or Islam or anything, is intended to give us a little distance from the relentless mythologization of these figures into symbolic demons. Pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, well, I do hope that this will continue. We will have a chance to say this to more people, and more people will be able to come up to this and say it like this Merwin too did, and you know, give some distance to these other people from this mythology that they're so caught up in. Well, Charles, I have to say goodbye. I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me back again, and I enjoyed the conversation we had this afternoon, and maybe we can have another time.
I hope so. I will plan on it. Okay, and good luck in your coming weeks with all your interviews and so on.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.